From KUAZ, Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up on today's show, what exactly is the process a person goes through when they change their mind? I'll talk with U of A psychology professor Jeff Stone about cognitive dissonance, attitude, and persuasion, and how they affect what we think about the world. Claudine LaMonaco interviews Richard Grant about his book, God's Middle Finger. It's a journal of his adventures on a journey across the Sierra Madre Mountains. We'll introduce you to a multi-talented artist who's pursuing her creative dreams in Tucson. Hear the music and poetry of DeVee when she talks with Tony Paniagua about her inspiration. And hear about the proud tradition of flamenco dance and the important role it plays in the life of one Tucson woman and her family in a story produced by Martine Rubio. That's all coming up next on Arizona Spotlight. Every year, we make New Year's resolutions and we break them. But what exactly is it that can make a person truly change their mind? It can be a difficult process both to achieve and to understand, and there are certainly plenty of therapists, politicians, and advertisers who would love to know how it works. My next guest is Dr. Jeff Stone, a psychology professor who heads up the Self and Attitudes Lab at the University of Arizona. Jeff teaches and conducts research on self-esteem, attitude, and persuasion, and I ask him to tell us about the psychology of change.
Well, what we investigate is the experience of hypocrisy, which we define as a situation where somebody advocates a course of action, like a health behavior. We should all exercise. We should all use sunscreen to reduce our risk for skin cancer. And that by itself is not actually very powerful. In fact, we find that just saying everybody should do this health behavior doesn't actually lead to much change. What gets people to become motivated to change their behavior is after they've advocated this course of action, we then make them aware of the fact that they themselves don't do what they just told everybody else to do. And that inconsistency, that hypocrisy, as we call it, motivates them to want to now practice the behavior, practice what they just preached.
How do you make someone face hypocrisy?
That's a really great question, and the research shows that, in fact, if you publicly humiliate people about being a hypocrite, they don't change their behavior. They do just try to justify it or rationalize.
They become defensive.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Because, I mean, essentially you're calling them dishonest, you're saying they're not being sincere, and nobody wants to think of themselves that way. What we find in our research is that in order to make people feel the hypocrisy in a way that motivates them to change their behavior, they have to be allowed to discover their past failings on their own, or at least give them an opportunity to reflect on their past behavior in a private way so they don't feel humiliated by the fact that they don't do what they just said everybody else should do.
Is that the definition of cognitive dissonance?
Cognitive dissonance is an uncomfortable state of tension that we feel when we realize that our behavior is inconsistent with our beliefs, our attitudes, our values, our morals, and we become motivated to reduce that tension somehow. And what hypocrisy does is cause a state of cognitive dissonance that seems to focus people on changing their behavior to reduce the dissonance. People can experience dissonance without anyone else knowing about the inconsistency simply because, you know, the inconsistency is uncomfortable for them. We generally want to believe that we are consistent, that our attitudes, our values, our beliefs, our behavior all go in the same direction. You can add to that somebody else knowing about the inconsistency, and that just makes it even worse. So I think that's likely the case, that when our hypocrisies are pointed out to us by someone else, we may experience that as an even more powerful source of discomfort. The interesting question is, then how are we going to reduce it? And here I think when we experience it ourselves, are allowed to realize our hypocrisy on our own, well, that's uncomfortable. We become motivated to reduce it by altering our behavior because we want to see ourselves as having honest and sincere intentions. When somebody else points it out to us, though, now we're a little humiliated publicly and we have to account for what we've done. And so you can't easily own up to the mistake under the circumstances. That would essentially say you've been foolish, you've been insincere, you've been dishonest. That's when I think people are going to be motivated instead to save face by trying to rationalize or explain the discrepancy. And that's what we see our politicians doing. That's what we see anybody who's sort of called out publicly for being a hypocrite.
And can someone completely override the process of positive change through using rationalization?
Oh, yeah. That's a very common response. I would say the vast majority of the literature that's investigated cognitive dissonance and responses to it show that response. That's actually what made our research somewhat unique. Rather than people just rationalizing, explaining away discrepancies between their behaviors and beliefs, here you see people sort of owning up to the mistake or the transgression and actually trying to right the wrong. And so it's kind of unique in the literature in that respect, showing that people are actually sort of owning up to the things that they've done and trying to make up for them, make amends for them.
Have you noticed an effect in your own life on the way you view your behavior and actions?
Yeah, I think there's an awareness of being careful not to say one thing and do another. But what's interesting is even though I'm aware of issues like, am I using sunscreen as much as I should now that I live in Arizona? You know, there's times when I don't. And again, it's part of the fascination for me with this is that there seems to be this compartmentalization in most people's heads, including my own, that keeps my behavior separate from what I know I should do. And, you know, those two things somehow don't come together for people most of the time. And we found a way to bring them together and change that. But it doesn't seem to be the default for people a lot of times. And there's probably good explanations for why that's the case.
Give us a couple.
Distraction. You know, cognitive load. People have a lot of things going on all the time. They can't be paying attention to every little detail of everything all the time. People like their distractions like TV, and that's a time when we aren't being really terribly mindful of other things. So, yeah, there's real common everyday processing issues that probably keep those things separate for us.
For the people listening in the audience who maybe are thinking about making a change in their own behavior regarding something that they know is good for them, can you give them any kind of suggestion on how to get started down that road?
Well, certainly behavior change starts with knowledge and knowing what it is you need to do to change your behavior. People typically can't get started changing their behavior unless they understand what to do. So learning about what it is you're supposed to do or what you want to accomplish is really critical. The next step in it is to really plan and set goals and try to achieve those goals. And part of this process that we investigate is almost like what happens when people have goals and then realize that they're not reaching them or they're not meeting them. And it's a very similar process where you realize there's a discrepancy between where you want to be and where you currently are, and that can motivate people to keep going. So those are two really key and I think well-documented steps in the change process as we understand them now.
British travel writer Richard Grant has lived in Tucson for the last 16 years. His latest book is titled God's Middle Finger, the story of a trip he made across the Sierra Madre Mountains. Next, Richard Grant joins Claudine LaMonaco to talk about his book.
Richard Grant first got the idea to travel the length of the Sierra Madre Mountains. Everyone warned him against it. The area is home to bandits, drug lords, and cave-dwelling Tarahumara Indians. The region is so rugged and remote, neither the Spanish nor the Mexican government could ever quite conquer it. Reading pages of the book, author and fifth-generation border cowboy J.P.S. Brown tells Grant he has to prepare by learning Spanish and how to ride a horse. Then he corrects himself. Let's say you were fluent in Spanish and a horseman, he tells Grant. I still don't see how you can do this without getting killed. Grant persisted, and the result is God's Middle Finger. The book has been met with critical acclaim and recently received a rave review in the Los Angeles Times. I began the interview by asking Grant to read a passage.
Okay, yeah, this was down in the town of Urique in one of these canyons that are deeper than the Grand Canyon. I just showed up there and had a meal. Behind Raphael's restaurant was a garden with some fruit trees and white plastic tables and chairs, and it was there on the Tuesday of Easter week that I met two young men called Pancho and Jose. They had gel-spiked hair and were wearing cargo pants and Nike sneakers. They beckoned me over to their table, poured me a plastic glass of beer, admired my pen, and then took it as a token of our newfound friendship. "You want to buy some?" said Pancho without further ado. $100 a kilo. We have a new machine in town that packs the kilos very tight. "Oh, no, thank you," I said. "I'm not here to buy mota. I'm here to see the Tarahumara Easter Fiesta." "How about grenades?" he said. "I have some very good grenades and a rocket for them." "The rocket shoots the grenades?" I asked. "Yes, it works very well, very strong." "It's not my business, but why would anyone need rocket-propelled grenades in Urique Canyon?" Pancho gave me the patient, pitying look, the look that Mexicans give gringos when they ask unforgivably stupid questions. Helicopters, he said. Sometimes the army comes in helicopters. We used to string cables across the canyons to bring them down, but these work much better. I don't need to shoot down any helicopters, I said. Hombre, you can use them for anything you want. There's bandits around here. You see bandits on the road? Boom! How about some cocaine, chimed in Jose. We can get some cocaine right now from Pancho's aunt. Ah, no thank you, I said. I gave it up because of the hangovers. But tell me, are there police here? Do they make trouble? Ah, there is no problem, said Jose. They both grinned. My brother is a police officer, and we are training to be police officers ourselves.
That's great.
So there are some police officers, and maybe some mayors, and a kind of skeleton structure of authority in the Sierra Madre. But what you find out is that nearly always the police are not just corrupt, they're actively involved in drug trafficking.
How did you start out to write this book?
Well, I think living in southern Arizona, you've got this mountain range that begins just across the border into Mexico, the Sierra Madre Occidental. And if you stand in a parking lot in Douglas, you can look up and you can see the northern fingers of the mountains right there. And then I found out that these mountains, they go on for 850 miles through northwest Mexico, and that they've never really been governed, and there's never really been any law in the sense that we would understand law. Then I discovered that there was Apaches in the Sierra Madre that were still living free and unsurrendered into the 1930s. And then I discovered that it was now one of the biggest drug-producing areas on Earth. And then I discovered there was 4 canyons deeper than the Grand Canyon and 6 others nearly as deep. And then I discovered there was a tribe of Indians who were still living in caves. And it just kind of seemed like this sort of slightly mythical remnant Wild West up there. And I just couldn't stop thinking about it. I wanted to go and travel through it.
How difficult did you find it to travel through the Sierra Madre?
Well, the only way you can really travel safely in the Sierra Madre is to get someone from there to take you up in there under their protection. Kind of a pass the gringo, you know. This is my gringo. Take good care of him. See that he doesn't come to any harm. I promise you he doesn't work for the drug enforcement agency. I promise he's not going to get anyone in any trouble. And I vouch for him.
But you got into trouble because that system eventually broke down, didn't it?
Well, the system broke down. I ran out of custodians. I ran out of contacts. And I started traveling alone, which was kind of breaking my own first rule, and nearly paid for it.
Can you tell me about what happened?
Things had gone wrong a few times already, but I'd sort of managed to scrape through. And then I got down as far as Durango, which is probably, I think, more than 600 miles south of where I started. And I saw this sign, first of all, I heard about it, and then I saw a sign for a tourist center way in a remote part of the mountains. And I thought that would be a good sanctuary to sort of meet some people and make some friends and make some contacts. So I went up there to this tourist center, according to its sign, and the place was half built, and there was 2 guys there with guns, and they just looked at me when I arrived like I was a big pork chop that had just flopped down onto their plate. And there ensued a very frightening night for me. I was desperately trying to make friends with them, and they were desperate. Meanwhile, they were saying things like, "You mean you're here alone and unarmed?" They kept asking me, "You know, you mean you don't have a gun? You've come up here on their own?" And I was like, "Yes, you know, I've come to write about your tourist center," and sort of frantically trying to justify my presence there and make friends with them. And then occasionally they would hand me a beer, and then we would be amigos, and then it would all turn hostile again, and they would become incredibly suspicious. Eventually, I wound up running away from them and running and hiding in the woods for most of the night. They came after me in a pickup truck with high-beam lights on, and then they went off, and then they came back with 2 extra men with flashlights, and then I was basically running and hiding most of the night from these guys, and was very lucky to get away. And when I eventually managed to get away, I was sort of faced with the choice of continuing south and finishing off the last 250 miles of the mountains. And my decision was to turn north and drive back to America as fast as my truck could carry me. And that was basically the end of my journey and the end of my book.
the title of the book is really great. Can you read the passage where that title comes from?
Yes, the title of the book is God's Middle Finger. I got this title that I was at a Tarahumara Indian Easter ceremony down in one of these deep canyons. And it was about a three-day ceremony. People dressed up and painted themselves, and they were carrying wooden AK-47s with the rattles on and shaking them. Everyone got very drunk, and it was kind of like a wild melee. Let me read the relevant passage here. The faithful were lifting up effigies of Christ and Mary onto platforms and getting ready to march them outside in another procession. Then they lifted up a third effigy with a beard and a long green robe. "Who is that?" I asked. "Ah, that is God," said the old man. A silver orb dangled from God's arm, representing the world. His right hand was raised up and turned outward, and over the years all his fingers had broken off except the extended middle one. God was flipping the bird.
That's great. Why did you decide to use that image for the title of the book?
Partly if you look at a map of the Sierra Madre, it kind of looks like a big finger sticking up towards the United States. And the sort of raised finger just seemed to echo the sort of general attitude of the Sierra Madre, which is kind of hostile towards outsiders and prickly and easily riled. And there was also just something slightly degraded in that God's hand with all the fingers broken off. I mean, it is a kind of place where human society and human decency is degraded. There's a lot of murder, there's a lot of rape, there's a lot of sort of extreme human misbehavior, and behavior just gets pushed into kind of strange extremes.
We'll have more Arizona Spotlight right after this break. Chances are good that you or someone you know has had dreams of making a successful career as an artist. It's a common desire, but few people are able to make the commitment to pursue it full time. Next, Tony Paniagua introduces us to DeVee, a woman who graduated with honors from Harvard, who is now pursuing and fulfilling her own artistic dreams right here in Tucson.
Her name is DeVee. She is 32 years old, and she moved to Tucson in 2006 from Patagonia, Arizona. But prior to that, she attended Harvard University, where she graduated with a bachelor's degree. Now DeVee is concentrating on her music, poetry, and art. Thank you very much for joining us. Let's begin with your name, DeVee. It means of life in French. Explain that for us, please.
Yeah, it means of life, and actually my full name is Fleur DeVee Weinstock. It is my birth name, and it means flower of life, growing next to a grapevine.
And how long have you been pursuing music?
Well, I've been studying music and writing since age 7, when I started piano lessons, and around then is when I started writing journals also.
Why do you think you do this? Why is it such a passion in your life?
Well, a friend of mine said to me once that creation is joy. And it's basically this amazing way to co-create with the universe and to go fully into life energy, which is creative energy.
Okay, you've put out a couple of CDs, and we have a copy of one of them here in front of us. And one of the songs in that CD is called The Incredible Emptiness. Will you tell us about that song, please?
Yeah, that song, it's based on a poem called Incredible Emptiness. And it's basically about communing totally with sound and being totally hooked in to the musical part of the brain. So it's a little bit about trying to get to that place.
So you play your own piano when you do your songs, but this is not the only instrument that you play. I'm looking at what looks like a wooden board right now with spoon handles.
Well, it does look like spoon handles, but they're not. And it's basically a deluxe thumb piano, and it's called the Imbita Dzavadzimu, which means notes of the ancestral spirits, and it originated in Zimbabwe.
And let's hear that, please.
Sure. This is Kizanga.
Sounds beautiful. I wouldn't think that that would be able to produce those sounds.
Yeah, it's an amazing instrument.
And so you're very spiritual. Why do you find that this is such an important part of your life in addition to the music? Or you basically blend it all together?
Yeah, well, I view spirituality as life also. I view creativity as life. And it's basically asking the fundamental questions of why are we alive and what is the purpose of our life. And I would hope that my creative work inspires people to ask those questions rather than just going along with kind of a sleeping status quo.
Of course, we also know that you like poetry and you are committed to poetry. Why don't you read one of your poems for us?
You woke up many years ago, felt life as it was meant to be, and then something happened. You got carried away in a river you couldn't stand or understand, and years lost, dying in constant efforts to kill feeling. And it didn't work. I choose to feel.
Tell us about the inspiration for that poem.
The you in that poem is actually me, as well as a lot of other people. And it is about the journey of being fully alive with feeling. So it's really an invitation to myself and everyone else to go fully into their emotional self.
Divi, you're doing music, poetry, and art. Many people just dream about this, but you're actually making it happen. How do people contact you?
They can look on my website, which is myspace.com/yourdevi, spelled Y-O-U-R-D-E-V-I-E, and there's also a number and poetry list sign up on there.
All right, Divi, thank you very much for joining us, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Tucson's rich cultural landscape provides us with many opportunities to sample some of the world's great art. Flamenco is a style which originated in Andalusia, Spain. But next, we'll introduce you to some Tucsonans who are dedicated to preserving, promoting, and celebrating this unique form of expression. This story was produced by Martine Rubio.
Flamenco is just another language of interaction. Everyone sitting down at the table, greeting each other, warming up to each other, communicating, basically, and having relationships with each other. My name is Mele Martinez, and I teach and dance flamenco. flamenco is an art form that started in the southern part of Spain, Andalusia, by the gypsies who lived there. And it's basically an art form that encompasses three ideas: music, dance, and singing. And right, together, and left. It has to start from when you're a young age to get the feeling of flamenco in, for sure. Learning rhythm, learning music, all needs to happen from an early age. So it's really good to start when you're a child. And that's how they start you in flamenco when you're in a flamenco family. And in Spain, you don't start learning when you're 12 or 15. You begin at birth in utero. Repeat after me. Ay, le, le, le. It's a family type of affair. You know, it's a community type of affair. It doesn't matter really if you're a man or a woman. Both really take part. Of course, my husband's a dancer. There's a pretty good population of people, I think, in the United States who have heard the word flamenco, but there's not a very big population of people who know what that specifically means. Mindset right now, I think, usually means José Greco and what flamenco was, you know, maybe 50 or 60 years ago, and it really has evolved a lot. Flamenco, for the most part, in Spain, done in a traditional way, is not on a huge stage in front of, you know, 1,000 people. It's done in a small setting. Sometimes a party, sometimes just an informal gathering, and not necessarily just to do flamenco. A lot of times they get together to have a dinner party and it turns into flamenco. That's, you know, the spontaneity is really a huge part of how it happens. In this particular venue, you can see their faces on the faces of the people watching. So it was different that way because it's a little bit intimidating, but it also makes things so much closer, makes you really feel the humanity is right there, you know, so it's nice to have them that close. Well, I hope she gets an understanding of appreciation for things that not necessarily the rest of the world appreciates, things like music and community and understanding of the body and how the body can express so many things through movement. Those things are extremely important in my family, and I just hope that she is able to carry on that feeling in her heart too. I believe that God is really the only reason why I have the ability that I have to do and the only chances that I have to do flamenco too. And so I really try and communicate the love that God has given me to everyone else. It really is kind of a showing to the audience of how much I love the people who happen to be standing right next to me or behind me playing music and doing palmas for me and supporting me.
That's Arizona Spotlight for this week. Thank you for listening. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio, Arizona Public Media. You can listen to Arizona Spotlight online at KUAZ.org. I'm Mark McLemore.